In the late 70s, Floyd Schultz was an Olympic-caliber athlete, completely dedicated to his sport. In his case, the jumping, the throwing, and the running of the decathlon.
Everything I ate, everything I drank, everything I did was devoted towards improving myself physically, to getting a little faster, to getting a little stronger, perfecting my technique in the discus and the pole vault.
But Floyd Schultz missed his chance to compete. See, he was class of 80 when the Olympics in Moscow were boycotted by the U.S. Floyd was crushed. He had no idea what to do. Years later, he wound up in the Green Mountains of Vermont as a master bird carver. And the first competition he entered, he won first prize.
I was reinvigorated with that feeling of winning, that incredible emotional uplift you get from knowing that you are considered to be a little better than those around you. And that is a prime motivator.
Floyd Schultz going from fastest to finest. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The Olympic torch run continues to draw its share of protesters. People angry about China's treatment of its citizens in Tibet are using the event to criticize China's human rights record. Many are talking about a boycott of the opening ceremonies, and a number of national leaders have already said they will not attend. There are even some suggesting an actual boycott of the Games, though that suggestion has very few supporters. Floyd Schultz lived through one of those. He was in the final stages of training in 1980 when U.S. President Jimmy Carter confirmed the Olympic boycott.
I can't say at this moment what other nations will not go to the Summer Olympics in Moscow. Ours will not go.
Well, I didn't want to believe it. You know, you devote 5 years of your life to something with that dream of even just being part of that thing that most kids dream about, when you have to really let it sink in and just replay it over and over in your mind. And it's something that took me several weeks to really start thinking about.
I'm talking today with Floyd Schultz about the loss of his Olympic dream and how he found his next challenge in the carving of a wooden bird. Floyd says that early on in high school, all he wanted to do was make the team.
I wanted so much to be a football player, and I went out every day and practiced and did everything that the football players were told to do, and yet I hadn't really physically developed yet. I was very tall, very thin, and incredibly uncoordinated, and quite insecure as well. And it was made evidently clear in 1973 when the head football coach called me in his office. He had a brick on his desk with his last name on it. You know, he was everything you'd think that the football player type coach should be. And he said, "Schultz, you know, it really bothers me to see you go out every day after school and banging your heads with these guys." And he said, I just don't know where I can fit you on a team. In essence, I think that your time would be better spent maybe pursuing something else because, you know, in my opinion, I just don't think you have much athletic potential or athletic ability. And those are tough words for a 13-year-old, 14-year-old to digest.
He didn't say, go away, come back next year when you're a little bit more grown up or a little better, more coordinated, nothing like that. He just said you don't have any athletic ability?
He didn't leave the door open to come back. He thought that I was, in essence, wasting my time. I was stunned. I remember believing him, thinking maybe he's right. But I wanted so much to be a part of the team. First off, football players were very popular. My father played semi-pro ball. He was an ex-Marine tough guy, and I felt I had something to prove. And yet it just physically, I'd look in the mirror and I would see a person who didn't have the physical tools to go out there and endure this type of training. And I remember discussing my father about it, and he said, well, give it time because your biological clock hasn't clicked in yet, but when it does, you'll be surprised. And true words were never spoken. But I was truly devastated.
I was so insecure myself at 13, 14, that if someone had said that to me, I probably would never have done anything athletic again.
Well, I didn't leave his office full of self-confidence, if that's what you mean. I was so insecure at the time that I recall misspelling my name on my gym shorts. I was just unmercifully crucified for that.
It's not like someone else had done it, though. You'd written your name.
I had done it because I was terribly distracted. I was very nervous, and I was trying hard to fit into the environment. And, you know, I was all just gangly, size 13 feet, knees and elbows.
How did you ever return to sports? Tell me how that came about.
Well, I could run quite fast. I always had great speed for someone my height. And I was very close friends with the head track coach's son, and he suggested that I try out for the track team. And so I did, and found that there were certain events that appealed to me tremendously, like the high jump and the hurdles and the long jump. And I like that feeling of being out on the track and just running. I really enjoyed that feeling of freedom that it gave me.
And you were good?
Better at track, I think, than football at the time. I found something that I really liked, and I could outrun most of the guys on the team. I sort of fit into it very comfortably.
What was the moment when you thought, hey, I may have actually found my sport here?
Well, when I set the high school high jump record my junior year, 6'3½". And the 6-foot barrier for a high school high jumper is a big deal. Felt pretty good about that.
That record still stand, you know?
I believe it does. I haven't been back to the high school in a long time. Last time I checked, it was still on the board, so.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Floyd Schultz began to experiment with other track events and found that he was good at those as well. Then his coach took him aside.
Late in the season, he said, the state championships are coming up, and you've already qualified in the long jump and the high jump. He said, I'm going to enter you in the decathlon. And I said, well, it sounds like fun, coach. The what? And he said, there's this event. It takes 2 days, 10 events. He said, if you can learn to pole vault safely, he said, I'd like you to try out the decathlon and see what happens. And there, the first day is the 100-meter dash, the long jump, shot put, high jump, ending with a 400-meter run. Next day, you begin with 110-meter high hurdles, discus, pole vault, javelin, and you wrap it all up with the lovely 1,500 meters. And you want to see a collection of big, strong men look like whipped puppies. Look at the decathletes lining up for the 10th event. Scary.
Were you filling out? Were you one of those big, strong men at that point?
No, not at that point. I was getting a little stronger, a little faster, but I was still the same body as the coach that told me he didn't think I could play football.
For Floyd Schultz, though, one thing led to another.
During that state championships on my senior year, I was approached by a coach from Central Connecticut State College. And I said, well, coach, I'm not really sure, but I'm thinking of enlisting in the Marine Corps. And he said, what? Give me 2 weeks. So I gave him his 2 weeks, and he had a dorm. He had me my classes before I was even officially enrolled at the college. I credit him for really snapping me into realizing that, hey, here's a big deal coach from a local college, and he thought I was good enough to gamble on as a prospect for his track team. I guess he saw a diamond in the rough, I suppose, athletically.
He was right.
Looking back, I'm inclined to agree.
Well, when did you start to fill out?
When I was 18 years old, things began to happen. I began putting on weight, but it was going in the right places. I could run faster. I was able to get in a good weightlifting program. I must have put on about 30 pounds of pure muscle. I was in that weight room 3 to 4 days a week, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day, and I enjoyed that feeling that every couple of weeks I could add a few more pounds onto my bench press or my squat. High school friends that saw me at the beach the following year thought I was on some form of a steroid program or something. I'd never heard of steroids, and, you know, they couldn't believe it. Same face, different guy.
And this would have been the same time as the 1976 Montreal Games, the Summer Olympics in Montreal. Were you paying attention at that time? Were you thinking, I wonder?
Well, there was this guy named Bruce Jenner that had just won the Olympics in 76.
Jenner's going to do it. He's won the gold, but he's going after the record, and he's going to shatter it. Jenner's got it. Jenner's won the Olympic decathlon. What a day for Bruce Jenner.
After he had won the Olympics, he came to our college university. He was like a hero to me.
I mean, was he the kind of physical specimen that he looked like on television? I'd never seen anybody with shoulders that broad and legs that strong.
He was. He worked incredibly hard, a very gifted athlete in his own right. But I know that he trained unmercifully. He pushed himself to limits. He was ripped.
And did he inspire you to pursue that same shape yourself?
Oh, yeah, you bet. He inspired a lot of people.
Floyd Schultz went on to win the NCAA championship in his junior year. He set records. He got engaged.
Boy, I was on fire. I just felt so good, yet I felt like I had not even come near my ultimate potential.
And now you're 1 year away from the Olympics. You must be
1 year away,
getting pretty
yes.
focused on that.
Oh, I had a T-shirt that said Moscow or Bust on it, and I'd been part of a collegiate national team that got to tour internationally, and I would wear my warm-ups and run through town. People would honk horns. It was a tremendous period for me of just unbridled enthusiasm.
I was going to say, this is really starting to sound like something out of a storybook at this point.
I was living a dream. I mean, I really had no limits and clearly had my sights setting on training and headed towards at least to the Olympic trials to give it my best shot. I was putting all my eggs in one basket and just going to go for it.
When were the Olympic trials going to be?
They were going to be in June of 1980, and they were being held at University of Oregon, and the weather out there was Jurassic-like. Mount St. Helens had erupted. Air was just filled with this dark, gray, greasy. It was a terrible thing to be looking forward to going into.
But all your training was then focused on that moment and beyond that on the Olympics.
Yes, we trained at the time in what was called a pyramid training philosophy, where we would, at the base of the pyramid, you would do your long, slow distance, a lot of weight training to build your aerobic capacity as an athlete. And as the season neared, the intensity would increase, the distances would decrease, and you would begin working, fine-tuning your event. The brutality of the training for decathlon meant a seven-day-a-week commitment. In addition to taking classes and working part-time at night, I was still training 5-6 hours a day. When it's been cold and rainy and I've been out at my 7th mile of a 9-mile run, or when I was attempting to lift some incredible amount of weight, I wanted to peak right in the spring of 1980. That was when I was planning on reaching the pinnacle of that pyramid. I was given a scholarship. It was the first time ever a track scholarship had been issued, and I used the money to buy an engagement ring. The year of 1979, I was truly on top of the world on every level.
Floyd Schultz says he was so much on top of the world that he was barely paying attention to what was happening in the news.
I have given notice that the United States will not attend the Moscow Olympics unless the Soviet invasion forces are withdrawn from Afghanistan before February 20th. That deadline is tomorrow, and it will not be changed.
Floyd Schultz thought that his world had come to an end. He certainly had no idea what was next, and no inkling that his talent carving wooden birds would gather him even more attention than his athletic prowess ever would. All that's up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. There is not much talk of an Olympic boycott these days. There are those who are critical of China and would like to see things change, and there are people who will skip the opening ceremonies of the Games this summer in Beijing. But there's also a recognition that earlier Olympic boycotts of the athletic events didn't have the effect on policy that some might have hoped. Floyd Schultz would certainly agree with that, and he should know. He was an Olympic-caliber decathlete in the final stages of training when a news bulletin crashed into his world.
Good evening. The United States will not be sending a team to the Moscow Olympic Games. That was the decision today by the U.S. Olympic Committee.
The day was April 12th, 1980. I was warming up by the high hurdles, and I was stretching. And I remember it vividly as Coach Kelleher came out across the track, and his shoulders were slumped down. It wasn't his usual jaunty self. Coach called us together, and he says, "I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but it's official that no one's going to Moscow. You know, nobody's going. It's going to be boycotted." So he was very upset about it, as you can imagine we were.
The moment you heard the news, physically, what was that news like for you?
Well, I didn't want to believe it. You know, you devote 5 years of your life to something with that dream of even just being part of that thing that most kids dream about. It's like being notified of the sudden death of a loved one when you have to really let it sink in and just replay it over and over in your mind, and it's something that took me several weeks to really start thinking about, because up to then, everything I ate, everything I drank, everything I did was devoted towards improving myself physically, to getting a little faster, to getting a little stronger, perfecting my technique in the discus and the pole vault. You know, you take that carrot away and you wonder what it is you're devoting all of your time to, and is it worth it?
So what did you do, Floyd? Did you stop training right away?
No, I didn't stop training because I was committed to the track team at large at our university. We had a full schedule, and I had already qualified for a lot of major competitions throughout the country. So I continued with my training, but it just, I wasn't as motivated as I was prior to, because I didn't see what it was I was devoting all this time and effort to and where it was going to take me. And I remember just not going through my warm-up drills properly, and things weren't going great with my engagement to this beautiful girl I was engaged to. There were cracks that were occurring in that emotional state of mind for me. And things just began, you know, the veneer of invincibility to me emotionally and physically began getting a few little cracks in it.
Was there a moment when it all sunk in?
It happened in Dartmouth in 1980 during the New England Championships when I was leading the decathlon competition by a lot. And I had a score going at the time that would have put me probably in well within the top five in the country. And I was to the seventh event of the decathlon, which is the pole vault. And we had just gotten these new fiberglass poles, and they were extremely responsive. And I'd been flirting with this pole a little bit, and I said, I'm just going to go for it. I have nothing to lose. I'm just going to go for it. And the bar was up to 15 feet in a vault. And I planted in my approach, shot straight up in the air, and came straight down. And I dropped from 16 feet right down. And
you mean you fell on the track, not on the cushion?
I didn't fall on a cushion. No, I went straight up. The pole vault, the momentum carries you forward in your vault, and all of that drives you into the pit. Well, this pole was so stiff that as I planted, I went straight up and just crashed. And I remember just sitting there thinking, this is it. What a way to end. Coach came over. We put a big ice bag on my left hamstring. Still was able to throw the javelin, which is the ninth event. I got off a javelin throw with a badly taped up left leg, just limping. I stood there and just gave it an arm throw, and I still took second in the New England Track Championships that year. And the NCAA meet was coming up in about 3 weeks after that, so I decided to start getting some very intensive therapy for this at a chance of getting back into the NCAAs, which I had already qualified for.
And did you compete in the NCAAs that year?
I went, got in 100 meters for the blocks, the gun went off, and then at 50 meters, I felt like I'd been shot with a shotgun, a 12-gauge, right in my left leg. The pain was unbelievable. I hit the ground and just, you know, my leg had hemorrhaged, and I tore the hamstring.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Floyd Schultz says, back then, everything was wound up with the effect of the Olympic boycott.
No question about it, because you're the prime motivating factor for you as an athlete. Let's face it, if I were a baseball player, you know, I could always look to the major leagues or football or any hockey, anything like that. But track and field isn't what I would call a marquee athletic pursuit from a popular standpoint. So the Olympics was the one place where you could really look to as a destination for all of that training and all that suffering and all that your family goes through in supporting you in your travels and in your special dietary needs. That Olympic horizon that it's so focused on suddenly was erased.
Did you think in 1980, oh, that's all right, I'll just keep going and I'll be in the peak of form for 1984?
No, I just didn't want anything that I couldn't even watch the Olympics in 84, and I couldn't. Not until the late 80s into the 90s could I even begin to watch again, and I just didn't want to know. I knew that curtain on that aspect of my life was coming to a rapid close.
And how bad did it get in the spring and the summer of 1980? I mean, you were still engaged. You were still in good physical shape, but
the engagement ended rather rapidly. I came back from L.A. and in essence, had my ring handed back to me and was told that she had met some wealthy young guy and worked for her father's company. And that whole summer of 1980 was one that I'd rather forget. It was all of these reminders of what I was going to be and all of the hopes and dreams of this little town in Connecticut suddenly weren't there anymore. So in addition to myself, I felt like I let a lot of people down. Working at the recycling center in Fairfield, Connecticut, down by the train tracks, smashing glass bottles into a bin. I worked there with a friend of mine, and I would just toss these bottles in there, and I thought, boy, I've gone from feeling like I was a king of the world to here I'm working in a recycling center just to make a few bucks to put some gas in my car, and everything was just terrible.
Did you go to graduation?
No, I did not. I couldn't even bear to go and see anybody. I just wanted to be alone. I was the first ever NCAA champion in the history of that university. It was a big deal to them, and I didn't want to see anyone. Friends of my parents, in the summer, they had come over and And I was feeling sorry for myself. And this guy that owned a hunting and fishing store, he and his wife had just built a log cabin up in central Vermont. And he said, "Will you quit whining about this?" He said, "Why don't you come up to Vermont and spend a few months up there and help work on our house?" He said, "That'll take your mind off of your problems. And, you know, come on up.
What'd you think?
The mountains, it'll do you good." Took him up on his offer in the fall of 1980, borrowed $100 from my best friend. I had an old Jeep. I put a guitar, a banjo, some carving tools, and a suitcase full of clothes, and felt sort of like Jed Clampett. I loaded it all in a Jeep, and I said, "Mom and Dad, I love you, but I've got to go figure this all out."
Floyd Schultz soon fell in with a group of musicians. He made new friends at a music festival and became part of the Manic Mountain Boys, or so they called themselves. Floyd says the bluegrass and Vermont were just the tonic he needed.
The Green Mountains of Vermont to me were like a big green embrace. As a place to just go and I could disappear, I didn't know a soul in the town I moved into. I worked as a logger. Physical work of logging turned out to do me a lot of good. We were in the woods at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, just as the sun was coming up, and it'd be 30 below zero, and we'd be out there cutting wood and chaining all the logs together and hauling them out of the woods, and it was incredibly hard, tough work. But I really liked it, and I was in pretty good shape. But at the end of the day, I remember going into the local grocery store where it was nice and warm and almost falling asleep in the aisle while I was choosing, you know, which brand of spaghetti sauce I was going to have that night for dinner.
Floyd says his time back in the mountains and living so close to nature helped turn him back to another pursuit, something he'd always done as a hobby, carving wooden birds.
That had always been something I had turned to in times of difficulty as a pursuit that brought me a great deal of pleasure was taking a block of wood, and I loved to carve birds. I was influenced by an uncle of mine who used to carve beautiful decoys. He passed away when I was about 12 years old, and through that gift that my aunt had given me of a few of his unfinished birds and a few tools, that was something that I always really loved to do. And so my bird carving was also becoming a very important part of who Floyd Schultz was in the early 80s.
Are you talking about sitting around with a bunch of guys with a penknife and a block of wood and whittling absentmindedly, you know, just seeing what comes out of it? Or are you talking about something that was more serious, even early on?
The notion that people get of sitting around a pickle barrel whittling chips on the floor couldn't be farther from the truth, because you're studying birds and you're trying to emulate the feather softness and the nuances of various species. It could be quite a challenge to turn a block of wood into something that looks soft and lifelike. I did it purely for enjoyment. I occasionally would sell a piece, and this is going back to when I was still working as a logger and doing a little house construction, but I did this in the evenings as a way to just unwind and to take my mind off whatever it was that was bothering me that day. It was always kind of an escape for me.
So you were working on this even when you were a kid then?
Sure. Carved my first bird when I was 10 years old. Sold my first bird carving when I was 12 years old for $10.
So you could have been a bird carver all along instead of an athlete.
Yeah. You know, at that age, you got to be cool.
And, I know. The girls aren't looking for bird carvers.
Typically not. Now, if you tell somebody you're into bird carving and that's your hobby, sometimes it wasn't something that I thought was a way to meet girls.
And when did it become more than that?
The turning point for my carving career came in 1983 when I had carved a crow, and it was on display in southwestern Connecticut at a friend's hunting and fishing store, and I had this crow on display down there, hoping it would sell. And a local carver, big-name carver, came in and noticed it and said, "Who did this?" And my friend told him, and he said, "Well, I don't know who the guy is, but he should enter that in the U.S. National Decoy Show." And my friend that owned the hunting store called me up and said, "Hey, you'll never guess who came in and saw your bird. He thinks you should enter it." And I said, "Well, I don't know about that." Long story short is I did enter it, and it won Best in Show. It changed everything. I realized that this thing that I'd always turned to as a bit of an escape and as something that I did for pure pleasure, maybe I can make a living at this. I ultimately sold that crow for what I would have earned 4 months of building houses.
Do you mind me asking what it sold for?
$7,000 to a collector at the time. And I'll be darned if he didn't write me a check for it right there. And that was a very exciting time.
I can see it, though, also being a bit of a challenge for you, because you're thinking to yourself, okay, now I'm going to do this seriously. Now I have to turn out another really good bird.
it was a concern because what I had done for pleasure and enjoyment and relaxation, can I do this every day and rely on this day in and day out?
So how did you ramp yourself up? I mean, you're thinking now you got to get a workshop.
I needed a workshop for certain to work in, but it was the lure of winning. When my crow was judged best in show, I was reinvigorated with that feeling of winning, that incredible emotional uplift you get from knowing that you are considered to be a little better than those around you. And that is a prime motivator. All life is a competition, and here was this way for me to carve a burden and go compete with it. It was that thrill of competition which spurred me to improve my carving techniques.
But you had seen the kind of victory that few athletes in this country see, to be an NCAA champion in an individual sport. The buzz, the high that would come from that kind of victory. Are you saying that there's a similarity between that and winning a bird carving competition?
Internally, yes. I think it's your feeling of satisfaction that you've worked incredibly hard to achieve a goal. And I would say ask anyone who's won a major award in anything, be it a Nobel Prize or a Pulitzer Prize or any type of book award. It solidifies in your mind that you're doing the right thing with your time.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Floyd Schultz was in the final stages of training for the Olympic decathlon in 1980 when an Olympic boycott ended that part of his life. But he says he still gets inspiration from one moment in his athletic career. And it wasn't a victory or a new record.
What keeps me driving forward, carving that next feather or doing a little bit, another hour or two of work at night, is the remembrance of that coach when I was in high school saying, I just don't think you've got, you know, the athletic potential.
He's still with you, that guy.
Oh, yeah. I'll carry that for the rest of my life. And it's, you know what, looking back, that's the best thing he probably could have ever said to me, because when I was training, I drew upon that and sort of as an I'll show you.
Amazing, though, that the voice of this high school football coach saying you have no athletic ability still echoes in your head, I don't know what, 35 years later.
Oh, I'll never forget it. I remember the shirt he was wearing. I remember finally had a chance to bump into him again, and he remembered that, too.
What did he say?
From my best recollection, of course, I don't want to romanticize this at all, but I was home for a month or two, and I was doing some stretching and training up on the local high school track and running some wind sprints, and he happened to be up there with a brother of his, and they were out just for a walk, and he saw me, and he laughed, and he said, "Why didn't you look like that then?" And I said, "Coach, you remember when you told me?" And he says, "You'll never let me forget that one, will you?" And I think one of my father's favorite sayings was, mountains wouldn't be mountains without valleys. And I took that valley, and it spurs me on to this day.
I read somewhere that you sold a bird carving for $500,000.
That's true. Yes. I've worked very hard at my art, and I'm proud of the level it's been taken to right now, and the collectors, the caliber of the collectors I'm dealing with, and the museums. There's in Bennington, Vermont, a beautiful little town in southwestern Vermont. The owners of the museum just invested a tremendous amount of money in building a museum wing that they're going to be dedicating to my work.
This is a permanent collection of your bird carvings.
Yes, there are some magical things happening. Birds appeal to everyone. I'll have little old ladies come through from the local garden club, and they'll have a story to tell about a bird they saw. Right behind them will be some big motorcycle gang guy with tattoos and a big leather jacket. He'll have some story to tell about a big hawk that he saw somewhere. And I don't think any other animal family elicits such an emotional response from people as birds do.
You know, Floyd, we started this conversation talking about your Olympic dream and how a boycott wrecked that. And since then, we've talked about you as an athlete and as an artist and as a writer and as an, you know, amateur ornithologist and a motivational speaker, and all those things roll together when you as all these different characters takes a look at what's happening with the Beijing Olympics, the call for a boycott, the people trying to interrupt the torch run. Tell me what you think.
I think they're all believing they're doing the right thing and for the right reasons. However, I think ultimately who suffers, it's the athlete that's out at 6 o'clock in the morning in that cold pool swimming laps. And that's the saddest part. I don't think politics has any place in anything as pure as Olympic competition.
And so for all the people who are watching the protests and listening to the calls for boycott and thinking to themselves, geez, you know, maybe it would teach those Chinese a lesson in human rights if we withheld our athletes. You'd say what to them?
There's different ways to get your message out, and I think putting it on the shoulders of the athletes who sacrifice so much is not the way to go.
Floyd Schultz is a master bird carver based in Hancock, Vermont. If you'd like to see some photos of Floyd as an athlete or as a musician or as a carver, you can go to our website at thestory.org. You'll see them all there. And you can also take a close look at some of his carvings. Thanks to Alan Nyrie, who listens to The Story on Vermont Public Radio, for steering us on this one. And if you have an idea or a story or an idea for a story that you'd like to pass along, you can go to our site as well, thestory.org, and leave me a note there. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. More news today about aftershocks within the housing sector. The Bank of America has announced some substantial new write-downs, reporting $2.7 billion in loans that are now regarded as uncollectible. The move comes amid news that foreclosures across the country are now up nearly 60% over this time last year. Well, desperate times, of course, call for desperate measures. A while back, I spoke with a real estate agent who knows of one unconventional method to sell a house. Ardell Della Loggia is a realtor in Seattle and one of a number who put faith in little statues of St. Joseph. Ardell was raised Catholic and says she only uses the saint sparingly. But not everyone is quite so restrained. She found out just how popular the statues are becoming when she went to buy one herself.
In fact, I had difficulty finding one, and I had to go to Amazon.com, which I thought was very Seattle.
What does that tell you about what's going on in real estate around the country? But we'll get back to that.
I got my St. Joseph. In fact, the Amazon.com package that arrived is a kit. It's a home selling kit, and it comes in a little box.
What did you get?
Well, you get the statue, and I personally like that version, which is a 3-inch plastic statue that is not painted. And I think that there's no way that you can do this with other people around and not laugh. Actually, I have to say, my business partner is not raised in any religion, and he did say, "Are you also going to sacrifice a goat and run around with his head on a stick?" You know, so. You know, I really don't get upset when people don't understand what's happening and what I'm doing. It only matters that I understand it, really, right?
Ardell Della Loggia says it was normal for her, growing up in a Catholic family, to assume that the saints would intercede. She tells one story about being attacked in a park. Almost immediately it began to rain, and the attackers fled. She says she never doubted that the saints were watching over her. But it wasn't until she was older and working in real estate that she first used, in fact, when she first heard of using, the statue of St. Joseph to sell a home.
The first time that I became aware of it was when one of my clients asked me to do this for her, and she was very embarrassed, actually. She was a Jewish woman. She went to a fortune teller because she was in distress about selling her house. And the fortune teller is the one who told her to bury St. Joseph. And she approached me, and so I knew something was up when she was tongue-tied and shy. And she said, "I really don't know how to ask you this. I'm sure that I didn't hire you to include this, what I'm going to ask you to do here. But I happen to know that you're probably Catholic since you're Italian and might know where to get a St. Joseph statue."
What did you tell her at the time, Ardell? Did you say, "Oh, this is a great idea. I'll get you a statue"? Or how did that conversation go?
It didn't surprise me at all. To me, it's not odd because I grew up having to learn how to ride a bike and cross myself when I passed the church while riding the bike. So talking about saints is not odd to me.
Did you buy the statue for her?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. And so it really was harder for her to ask me to do it than it was for me to do it. But let me take you back to where this comes from. Remember No Room at the Inn?
Yeah.
Everybody knows No Room at the Inn. Okay. So when you don't get the house you're trying to buy.
He didn't want to buy the
inn.
There's
no room at the inn. So that's, I mean, it's not a leap, you know, it's not a big leap.
No, no, fair enough.
And so it is, you know, in that day, the father's mission to find a place for his wife to, you know, have her baby in the manger.
Right.
And so looking for shelter for your family and St. Joseph are obviously connected.
So take me back to this friend of yours. You bought her a statue. Then what happened?
She asked me to bury it in the yard. My practice would be to bury it under the post. In Seattle, the way that our posts are, they stick across, and they look like a cross. So, you know, you're actually putting it under the arm of that cross.
So your friend who planted the statue in the front yard, did she sell her house?
Absolutely.
And soon after she planted the statue? I mean, was there a link there? What were you thinking?
The situation was they were actually losing their home in a bankruptcy, and not because they weren't paying their mortgage payment. What happened was the wife started her own business,
right,
and used the house as collateral for that business. And the business failed. And she felt, I cannot tell you, she just felt so badly that her family was losing their home, not because they couldn't afford the mortgage, because her husband still had his very well-paying job, but because she personally had failed in a new business.
And put the house up for collateral, and so she was losing it that way.
Correct. And there was no way out of it. They were just going to lose it.
You felt sorry for her then. That was part of the decision to help with the statue?
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. But and the thing about this woman, when there was a showing on her house, she worked, you know, and she would run home and she would vacuum, even though she already vacuumed. You know, if she was having a showing, she would run home and she would vacuum again. And when I asked her, you know, we were getting bad feedback on her house because it did have some dated issues. And we were pricing it higher than it was worth. It was worth $185. This is back in the early 90s, the last time we had a bad market. And we needed to sell it for about $210. And so, you know, I said, I think the feedback saying that your kitchen is blue and yet it isn't really blue, but the tablecloth is blue. Can you get a white tablecloth instead of a blue one? And she not only had a white tablecloth on there within the hour, she had three white tablecloths on there within the hour so that if it got dirty, she could just flip off the one and the other. And she was doing everything within her power. And remember, this woman was getting not a dime from the sale of her house.
Right. Right, because it was a foreclosure, the money was going straight to the bank.
Correct. To her creditors, actually.
Yeah.
So it wasn't near. So the equity, she had a lot of equity in her home, was going to pay off the debt from her business that failed.
So did she get the $210 that you'd hoped she would?
She did. She did.
And what do you think did it, Ardell? Was it the white tablecloths or was it St. Joseph?
I think that it really was a very unique purchase in that the person who bought it was somebody who had a unique interest in that particular house, in that particular neighborhood. It wasn't a popular neighborhood.
Yeah.
It wasn't a popular school district. It was a very hard area to get higher than market value. And I did feel that buyer was in many ways a benefactor for this family and a way for them to move on with their life and get past this.
So St. Joseph did have something to do with it in that sense.
I do think so.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Ardell Della Loggia says she's heard that some real estate offices are buying boxloads of the little plastic St. Joseph statues, the patron saint of real estate. Ardell says she'll only use one of the statues under certain circumstances.
I've only done this 3 times in 17 years. So, you know, I would say that's very reserved. But remember, you don't hear about St. Joseph when in a hot market. And we pretty much had a hot market from 98 through present. I did. All the places that I have been in that period have continued to be in an up market. This is the first time that I've seen a down market since the early to mid-90s.
So if we go back to the early 90s, you had mentioned this the last time we had a really crappy market. Were there a lot of St. Joseph statues being handed out at that time?
The stories were prevalent at that time. And I do remember reading stories about agents and even whole real estate offices buying like 1,000 of them, or, you know, agents buying them in hundreds.
So you yourself don't worry about annoying conservative Catholics who would go, I can't believe you're using a saint from the church for the sale of a house. I mean, shame on you.
Well, see, and actually that bothers me more. So the people doing it who don't believe in it don't bother me at all. On the other hand, yes, the Catholics who denounce the practice, I have a problem with that. I think that any time that a saint is being called upon to help a family in their endeavor, why would you say that's a bad thing?
You mentioned that you've used St. Joseph 3 times. You told me about one. What are the other two?
Well, the second time was not in a bad market. It was actually in Los Angeles in, I believe, Redondo Beach in 2001. And it was actually my broker built a house on spec.
Right.
And he was a very well-respected real estate agent in the community. He had worked there for 20, 25 years and very well-respected. Not every agent is very well-respected by their peers. And he purchased a piece of land with a developer, and they put a house on it. And it was, I don't remember the price, but let's maybe $2.5 million. It was right up by the ocean.
Yeah.
But it was on a piece of land where nobody would have previously speculated. It was not in a prime spot on the beach. And so I did hear some people laughing at him in a way and saying, oh, you know, that's never going to sell at that price. He's crazy.
What did you think? Did you think he was going to have trouble selling it?
That man knew 30 times more about real estate there than I did. Let's say 300 times more.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going to second guess him. I was very sad that he might be embarrassed if that happened. And so I went. I never told him at the time. I went and I bought the St. Joseph statue. My preference is to actually go to a place that is appropriate to purchase and not through the real estate office or Amazon.com.
Like the little shops beside the cathedrals.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. I went to St. Vincent's, I believe, in Redondo Beach, and I bought the statue. And I just took a walk and buried him under the sign, as is my practice. And that house sold very quickly, by the way, after I buried that. And I didn't tell him until after it closed because, all agents have that superstition.
Yeah, right.
you don't test things until it closes. And after it closed, and I believe he was an atheist. I believe that he respected my belief.
What did he say?
He laughed and he thanked me. I mean, he really thanked me and he laughed. And he really respected the fact that St. Joseph did probably do it for me, not for him.
And he was just the beneficiary of it.
Right? Yeah.
Did he give you any of the money from the sale? No.
I had nothing to do with
no,
that.
No, I understand
sale.
That. Hey, I have to ask you about one thing that I read somewhere, that apparently some people say if a house sells, and I guess if it closes, then you're supposed to dig up the statue and place it in a position of some reverence as a thank you. Is that a part of this or not?
If you're doing it for the buyer of the home, then you're supposed to dig him up and bring him inside the house that you got,
right,
in a place of reverence. But of course, if you're selling the home, you can't ask the people who buy it to bring St. Joseph inside. I guess you could. But
you could put him on your dashboard just so you could say thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what I did do back in the 90s in the bad market. And when I buried him in the yard, I did not take him out. I couldn't remember. That's why I am sticking to the practice of putting him under the post, because I know where he is. When I buried him in the yard, which was the request of the original woman who was Jewish, I didn't remember where he was. And so he's still there. And I feel badly. So what I did was I bought a second statue and I put him in my home. And I put him up in a place of honor in my home for quite some time. And I used to bring him to work with me. You know, and kind of have him as my patron saint of I was a new agent at the time, a relatively new agent. And I did become top agent in a year. And people did say, how the heck did you do that?
You said you used to bring him to work with you. Did you stop doing it?
Well, you know, I've moved to 5 states. You know, that St. Joseph isn't around. But I remember on June 30th, I had 6 closings in one day. And I remember saying, okay, St. Joseph, let's take a little rest now. And I laid him down, put a little blanket over him. We need a break.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Ardell Della Loggia sells real estate in Seattle. And given what's been happening in the housing market lately, it's no wonder that she says her business has a lot to do with faith. Ardell told me about another case where a family was about to lose its home due to a bankruptcy. It was particularly hard on the woman who lived there. The woman couldn't shake the idea that her family might wind up without a place to stay.
The woman kept waking up in a cold sweat, thinking that that was the day they were going to make her leave her home. And what I would do is I would take her out to look at a few homes, a few places that she could live in,
right,
that were much less expensive than where she was. But they had a son who they wanted to finish high school. And so and this went on for, I would say, in 9 months. But every month or two, she would, you know, get this fear. And her husband would call me and say, Ardell, you know, my wife is just panicked and having anxiety attacks. And what happened that, which was really very odd, is that on Christmas Eve, you know, they always have that big service at church with the little children. And my daughter was very small. And she had just watched that movie where Santa Claus, you know, is giving up on Christmas and he rides a sleigh and saves somebody's house or something in a sleigh race. And we went to church immediately after watching the movie. And the husband came up to me because he did go to our church. And he said, the bank let us keep the house. So in that bankruptcy of the business, they carved out the house and let them keep it.
Huh.
And my daughter looked up to me, and she couldn't have been more than 4 at the time, and she said, see, Mommy, Santa Claus does give people homes for Christmas. So, you know, I think if you look for the silver lining, if you look for the bright side, if your cup is half full, then you will have many, many experiences, as we do, where these things work and these things are valuable.
So
if you're skeptical, then you're not going to see them.
Look ahead for me at whatever's going to happen in the housing market, because you can read whatever you want, as you well know, that, you know, we're headed for, you know, our recession version of a depression and, you know, all our housing is going to be worth nothing. But are you suspecting that we're going to hear a little bit more about St. Joseph before we're through whatever we're in right now?
Absolutely. We are absolutely in a time, particularly for people who need to sell their homes, who purchased them recently.
Would there ever be a time, Ardell, when you would not use St. Joseph? If a client came up to you and said, hey, stick one of those statues under the sign, you know, I don't believe in it, I think it's just juju, but, you know, do it anyway, it can't hurt, right? I mean, would you say, no, I'm not going to do it in it?
You know, I wouldn't say no on that basis. To me, it's more about, you know, God helps those who help themselves. So where would I not bury St. Joseph? You know, if the seller overpriced the property, wasn't cleaning it, had dishes stacked up in the sink, unless there was, you know, some other reason, like they were suffering from depression, and then I would help them with that.
Right. No, I understand that. But what you're saying is that there's got to be some of the devotion to wanting to sell the house. It's not just devotion to the statue. They kind of go hand in hand as you see them.
I have the devotion. They don't have to have that devotion. But they have to be saying with their actions that they want the house to sell.
But
not with their mouth, but with their actions.
And so you're not going to go to Amazon.com and buy yourself a couple of dozen St. Josephs. You need them only every once in a while.
Correct. Though I would be more likely to have one handy.
I was going to say, I hope that stays true for the months ahead for you and for everyone else who's buying and selling.
I don't believe that you have to understand the entire practice in order to do it. And I think that St. Joseph is a saint that is very rarely mentioned. And, you know, personally, I think he appreciates the attention.
Ardell, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Ardell Della Loggia is a real estate agent in Seattle. Tomorrow on The Story, we'll hear from two people who decided to trade houses with each other. Sherry Crossland had retired in Virginia, but then she and her husband decided they wanted to move to California. She posted an ad saying she was interested in exchanging mortgages with someone. Well, it turns out Jerry in California answered the call and took her home in Virginia.
First of all, you really have control of your life. Instead of sitting on a house watching the value drop, all of a sudden you have absolute control of your life. I'm going to buy hers. She's going to buy mine for a price we agreed on. Now we got to settle the loan issue.
I've gotten in trouble my entire career for thinking outside the box. At least now it finally came in handy.
Jerry Stussman and Sherry Crossland tomorrow on swapping homes permanently. Lots of different ideas and creative thinking going into people's approach to the housing market these days. If you've got something that you'd like to talk about or know of an idea that you think has some currency, go to our website, leave me a note there. It's at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.